Hello, listeners, and thank you for once again joining us on this week's episode of Content Talks, the 5x5 podcast about content strategy. I'm your host, Christina Halverson, and I am more than delighted to welcome to today's podcast Ms. Karen McGrain. Karen is a managing partner at Bond Art Science. And for full disclosure, is also a good friend of mine, and we have made it clear that there are certain things that we are absolutely not going to talk about on today's podcast. So, Karen, you can just relax and be your content strategist expert self.
Oh, right. We're going to talk about content strategy.
Right. Okay. Right. This being the podcast on content strategy. Although I'm sure that people would happily tune in for the podcast on all the things that Karen and Christina are not going to talk about today, but that's not what's going to happen. Yes. So, Karen, tell me a little bit about yourself.
Christina. So I'm kind of like an old school user experience person. I got into this game like back when the web was really just like a big card catalog. And I've been doing, you know, all things that are involved in making the web better for the people who use it for about 15 years. And one of those things is content strategy.
Why don't you just give us a little rundown of your career path, as it were, because it's pretty interesting to me anyway. I may be biased, but go ahead.
Well, I went to graduate school back in the mid-90s, and I got a degree in what was basically technical communications and human-computer interaction. Which, you know, at the time, like, I think when I told people that I was doing that, they thought it sounded about as practical as Klingon language studies. But in, you know,
which was your minor.
Which was my minor, yeah. That, and religion. And, you know, but in retrospect, that was, like, I think, you know, an incredibly good training for me. I mean, I'm grateful every day for a lot of the practices and principles that I learned in grad school. And, you know, I find that it's like, I wish I could go back and take that program again, because I learned so much, and I'm still using that stuff every single day, especially as a content strategist, right? So after I left grad school, I was one of the first people hired at Razorfish, which at the time was maybe, I don't know, like 30 people, and, you know, was kind of really lucky. Like, I took the job because the guys who ran the place are all from Minnesota. And, you know, they're all from St. Louis Park. And I was like, my people. And, you know, that worked out really well. So I was there for almost 10 years. And, you know, I would like to say played a pretty significant role in helping to build the user experience practice there. I took over the information architecture group, or I started the information architecture group there in about 1998. And, you know, at that time, I always joke, at that time, it was like, I could have put out a job posting that just said information architect wanted, and anybody who knew what that was probably qualified for the job. but, you know, I got to work with a lot of really awesome people, hire people, you know, really learned a lot about going out to talk to clients about this crazy notion that there were people who were using their websites, and that meant that the website couldn't be just about what they wanted to say. It had to be about how their users thought about things and, you know, how they wanted to navigate, what words would make sense to them, you know, what they wanted to see. And, you know, that was a huge shift at that point. I mean, it's still a huge shift for a lot of businesses that they have to think about the web as something more than just marketing and more than just technology.
Right.
But it was great to be able to do that in the early days of the web. It's like those days were so crazy, and sometimes I really miss them. There was something super exciting about being able to go in to a business that really had no web presence at all, or had some like unbelievably bad website that the IT group had put up, and be like, oh my God, we have to make this entire website, and we have like 3 months to do it in, and we're all 25 years old and we don't know anything. So I did that for, until 2006 when I left to start my own small company called Bond Art and Science.
And when you left, what was your position there?
I was the VP and national lead for user experience. So okay. I had been running about a 50, 60 person group in New York. So that was, I ran the whole user experience group. So that was kind of like director level positions, like creative director, peer positions, as well as information architects, content strategists, and user researchers. And yeah, when I left, I joke about my job at that time that it was like, I went from, you know, actually doing things to telling other people to do things to telling executives that other people were telling people to do things. And when I got to that point, you know, you wake up one day and you're like, how did I get here? Is this really, you know, is this
not my beautiful house?
Yeah. And I don't say that. Like I'm super grateful for the time I had at Razorfish. I learned a lot and, you know, I have a huge amount of respect for so many of the people that I worked there. I learned from when I worked there.
Well, but
you miss doing things. Yes. I think for anybody in these kinds of senior roles, you do really have to question and challenge yourself and find the right balance of how much of what I do is leadership and how much of what I do is actually hands-on work.
And as we've talked about, that has been a huge issue for me over the last 2 years, taking on this role as an advocate and as a sort of leader within the community. Suddenly I find that I haven't been actively practicing content strategy for a while. So I can totally empathize with that feeling of suddenly just being like, I want to do stuff and make things.
Yeah. I mean, you really, you get to this place where you're like, wow, what's my job here? And, you know, if I were thinking about what my next job would be, would I be qualified to do it anymore?
Right.
Is someone going to hire me to make resource management spreadsheets all day long? And do I want that job? Because that's what I was doing.
Right.
And, you know, I think the best career advice I ever got was when I was reporting to J.P. Mayhew, who at the time I think was the CEO of Razorfish. He's now the CEO of Publicis Modem. And he was like, look, the more further along you get in your career, the more and more your time is going to get diffused by things that you don't necessarily want to do. And he was like, you have to be really, really clear about what those things are that make you happy and make you feel fulfilled and make you like your work. And you have to fight really hard to make sure that you get to do them. And, you know, build it into your plan for yourself, whether that's every month or every quarter or every year. Like, make sure you get to do that stuff, because otherwise you won't have time to do it and you'll wake up one day and you'll hate your job.
So we are going to talk about content strategy, but I actually want to sidetrack for just a minute to actually address that specifically, because I read just yesterday, and I've been meaning to retweet it, this really, really beautiful post by a young, like 20-something woman who is working in technical documentation and is talking about, okay, I'm really happy with my job right now, or I should be happy with my job because I'm doing all these things that ostensibly I love. I'm really making a difference in the company. I really like my coworkers, but why am I feeling so unfulfilled going to work day to day? So it's super important to know what you want to do, but I think that question is like, that looms heavy, I think, for a lot of individuals, you know, so I'm doing this and I should be liking it, but I don't. What is it that I really want to do? How do you get at that? I mean, how would you recommend to somebody in this young woman's position how to get at that?
I think the people who feel challenged by the work are the people who are always willing to take on something that is a bit of a stretch for them, or that they maybe aren't quite qualified to do, but are like, well, you know, I'll figure it out. And I think for many of us who are working in the digital space, it's like, there's lots of opportunities to do things you don't really know how to do.
Ooh,
or
yeah.
That, you know, and so I think it's a certain amount of fearlessness to say, okay, like, what can I do to keep myself from getting bored? And oftentimes that's, you know, taking on something that is a little bit outside of your comfort zone, just because there's a lot to be said for a little bit of panic,
right,
in your work.
Right.
And Michael Rand just had a really great post called Bored People Quit. And, you know, talking about it from a management perspective, particularly he's writing about managing engineers, but I think it applies to...
You mean Michael Lott?
Michael Lott, yeah.
Well, why he blogs under Rands remains a mystery to everyone.
Yes. My bad.
No, no. It's Michael's bad, actually.
Good labeling.
Yeah, good.
The idea that you should have a manager who is paying attention to your engagement with your work, and that you should be able to have someone that you can go and talk to about what's going to help you grow and, you know, still feel challenged and not feel bored. You know, that'd be another piece of advice I'd have for a 21-year-old working in this field is, you know, make sure that you develop that kind of relationship with the person that you're working for.
Right.
And learn how to manage your manager. Don't expect that somebody is just going to magically, you know, be able to read your mind and understand how you're feeling. Develop the confidence and the trust that you know that you can go in and talk to that person and say, here's what I'm thinking, this is what I'm working on, here's what I'd like to do next. You know, have those honest conversations on a regular basis and don't treat it like, oh, I have to wait for my performance review. Treat it like, right. It's my job to manage myself and manage my manager on an ongoing basis.
Right, right, exactly. I think too, you know, and this may seem more obvious and it also probably may seem more realistic for somebody just out of school, but just this, to really cultivate this curiosity about not only your discipline, but sort of, or your practice, but also related practices. That is something more and more, I think, that I get really fired up about, like Lou Rosenfeld's book that just came out on Site Search Analytics. I need to know more about that. I still have Bob Boyko's scary phone book of a content management Bible sitting on my desk that I flip through. And I think that even if people are, parenting, or if they're working more than one job, or if they're already working overtime at their current job, trying to find little pockets of time to be able to engage in sort of that larger conversation is so critically important, to continually sort of looking around to say, this isn't really lighting my fire. Oh, whoever guessed that content modeling would be something that I would be interested in.
Right. I think for anybody working in this field, whether it's content strategy or user experience or, you know, any of the other related fields, I think most people, when they're starting out, they have a front door that they come in through. Like, you know, I came in through the information architecture door. But if you're planning to work, you know, for any length of time, you realize that, oh, my success is going to come not just from my expertise in this one area, but through being able to understand and talk about and, you know, challenge myself to learn more about all of these different related areas.
Yep,
and
easy. Yep.
The longer you do it, the more you realize, like, oh, wow, there's all these different fields that I have to learn. And it doesn't mean, you know, it's like you don't ever necessarily have to be a great engineer, for example.
Right.
But, you know, you do certainly have to understand, like, oh, okay, what if the developer is talking about doing data modeling, like, what is that? And how does that relate to my work? Because I guarantee if you're working as a content strategist, that is hugely relevant. But it might not be something that you think about, when you're just starting out in your career.
Yep, exactly. And I think that point in particular feels really intimidating to people who, for example, are coming in through the editorial door or through the, copywriting door, or even through tech comm. And that was that, you know, I came in as a copywriter, and I've told the story way too many times about how I backed into content strategy almost more from a project management perspective, because projects just kept blowing up. But I think absolutely to just continually sort of be showing up and at least listening into the conversations, even if you don't understand half of what's being said, not that I've ever had that experience, is really critical. So now let's talk about content strategy. Karen, when I first met you, you came to speak at an event at the Minnesota Interactive Marketing Association. This was several years ago, and you guys had recently launched the redesign of the New York Times website, which was kind of a big deal. And you came to really talk about and present sort of the approach and how you led that team and participated in the redesign. And obviously your talk was really driven by the content strategy and the information architecture that had to take place and evolve in order to make this design work. Well, and vice versa, you know what I mean. Let's not get into the whole content first thing, shall we? Okay. that's a different interview. I'm going to call Ethan Marcotte for that. And one of the things that you talked about was the participation of content strategists, which at the time was still this sort of loose and fuzzy term for me. But then when I, you know, in 2008, when I started to think, more about content strategy and was doing my stalking thing, which I keep referring to every single time I bring somebody on this podcast, because that's pretty much how I met them, was by stalking them. that was when I reached out to you again, and we sat down in the Bond offices with your other content strategist, Josh, and basically just did sort of this huge information dump with each other about, well, here's what we knew, and here's the documentation that we used at Razorfish. Can you just talk a little bit about the emergence of the content strategy practice at Razorfish? Where were the gaps that arose that you saw this need to fill with some of the skills that have sort of coalesced under this discipline?
Well, I will say that I was extraordinarily lucky throughout all of my career in that Razorfish basically always had a content strategy group. When I got hired, my first job title was information designer / writer, which I look back on as one of the more hilariously overreaching job titles I will ever have in my life. What you're going to be doing is a lot of data visualization work, but then when you're not doing that, we would like you to do copywriting. There was another woman there who, the lovely and inimitable Camille Shandor, now Camille Habecker, and she and I both had that same title, and we sort of revolted at one point and were like, okay, this is a dumb title and here's what we want. I was like, I want to run the information architecture group and she's going to run the content strategy group. And so
you're all 25 and nobody knew anything. So they said, okay.
I talk about that time as I look back on it and it was like, I was too dumb to know that what I was doing was hard.
Oh yeah.
And and so I was just like, oh, great.
I feel like that every day.
Mm-hmm. So I, in retrospect, probably could have called the group that I was running interaction design. I'm sure I've just opened a whole can of worms here, but
not on this podcast. We don't go there here.
I think the work that we were doing was certainly more on the, let's think about the overall, point of view of the user. And then we were the ones that were responsible for making it tangible, tactile. And in those days, the web was a lot more static. So, it's like it really was a lot more information architecture. So in retrospect, the group that I called information architecture might have been called interaction design. And, I think if I were doing it again today, I would probably say that there should be two groups and one of them should be interaction design and one of them should be content strategy, which is not to open a whole can of worms with the IA community. But I think that as sites have become so much more dynamic and so much more, rich in terms of their interactive behaviors, I think that's where interaction design has kind of stepped in. When we named it information architecture, the web was really static. It was really a lot more about navigation and, pages that didn't change that much, whereas now, obviously, things change all the time on the web. And so, I think that having a separate content strategy group with people who really understood the content deeply and who understood both the editorial side of things, but also, we're really trying to work with clients on some of these organizational issues around who's creating this content, who's maintaining it, what's going to happen to the content after we as an agency hand you your new website baby and then, run back to our offices and you're the ones who have to deal with it all the time. We were having those conversations, I think, at a very early stage. And I feel lucky for being able to have had my work improved by the fact that there were other people who were thinking about similar problems, but from kind of a different angle.
One of the things that we talked about when we first met at the Bond offices was that even though you had, what was a fairly mature content strategy group, because it had been around for 10 years, and it was one of the only agencies that I could find that it didn't even had a practice called content strategy beyond just, a few writers or web editors. One of the things we talked about, though, was that even after all that time, it was still difficult to get the account people to actually sort of sell in content strategy, whether or not it was because they met with resistance from the clients or because they themselves didn't really understand the value. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of ongoing educational component that the CS folks at Razorfish had with regard to that?
Yeah, that was a really big deal to me. And I would say, especially starting in maybe like 2004, I really kind of got religion about how important content strategy was and really made it a point for myself and a point for a lot of the other people within the content strategy group that I wanted to evangelize it more internally. I wanted to make sure that we, you know, in our internal teams knew how to sell it, knew how to scope it, and I think knew how to push back on clients. I'm sure, you know, it's like anybody who works in content strategy knows this problem, which is that their client hires an agency because they think they need a website design or website redesign. You know, they think they need design and development. And you go in and you're like, well, hey, the content. And their response is, oh, no, we have all the content internally already. Like, we'll handle that ourselves.
Well, and it's not just, I'll interrupt and say, it's not just people who work in content strategy. It's also the designers and the developers.
Yeah,
I just talked to somebody today who is scoping with a different agency, who's scoping this gigantic multi-year, what is essentially a content strategy project, but the primary client there is like, no, I need to see visual interface and interaction design and features and tagging strategies for all this content that we already have. And it's just like, what do you do with that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I started to see projects really go off the rails because, you know, even though we might have a content strategy group or even, you know, even projects where we did have a content strategist working on the project, the magnitude of the problem was so great. And, you know, it was more than this one poor content strategist could tackle.
Yes.
And, you know, I started feeling like internally, I remember having a meeting with somebody where, you know, they looked at me and they were like, Karen, you want to know what the problem with this company is that IA is the solution to everyone's problems. And I was like, oh, wow. You know, it's like, because I had been running the information architecture group for so long that it was like, wow, I'm doing a great job and everybody wants IAs. And then you look at that from the other side and it's like, oh, wait a minute, I am like screwing up royally here. Like, you know, what that means is then you've got three IAs stapped on a project. They're having trouble dividing up the work. There's a lot of conflict. And I'm like, put a content strategist in here. Like you're going to get the same amount of work done. It's just that you're going to be having people who can collaborate better together as opposed to people who are, you know, whose brains all work the same way. So they're having trouble figuring out where each person can add value.
So go ahead.
No. So you go on.
Okay. Well, so my question is this, and this is something that you've been living and breathing for, you know, 12, 13 years, but I think that it is just a really compelling topic for so many people who are coming into content strategy, who are beginning to recognize the value of it. Can you talk a little bit about your understanding about the relationship between the information architect and the content strategist, and how, you know, 2 years ago, Lou Rosenfeld said he saw the two as really the two sides of the same temporal coin. Can you just talk a little bit about, you know, an ideal world, how those two roles can function together, with obviously the understanding, dear listeners, that there is not one skill set that is solely the domain of the IA and one that's solely the domain of the CS?
Yeah, I think, you know, I love thinking about those types of questions. And I think my experience of it is really formed by the fact that I had to run a enormous user experience group, and I had to hire people in into roles that had to be, by definition, sort of clearly defined. If you have a big agency like that and you're trying to staff multiple projects, you need to sort of tell people, like, okay, this is what your job description is, this is what somebody else's job description is. And, you know, having boundaries there can be frustrating for people, because I think most of us are like, well, I can do more than that. But on a systemic level, it keeps things a little bit more peaceful, because then people don't have to have these like border skirmishes around what their role definition is quite as much. At least that's the goal. And I think in my mind, the content strategist is really deeply understanding what all of the content is going to be. They're looking at it from the perspective of the reader. So really trying to understand what is the user coming to this page or this website looking to do, or what do they want to learn. But they're also looking at it from an organizational standpoint in terms of who's going to be creating this content, how are they going to maintain it, what are the tools we're giving them to manage that content. And, you know, it is something that I think more than any other role on the project needs to have the long-term view, needs to be the one that's saying, okay, this is not just about us creating this template and then who cares what goes in the template? We've moved on to the next project. It's somebody saying, hey, I need to make sure that what we have created sets up our client for success in the future. And that means that I have to understand our client's organizational challenges. I have to understand what they want to accomplish and make sure that you know, 6 months down the road or 9 months down the road, the site works just as well as when we delivered it.
And what would your input be to someone who says, yeah, we always ask that question, but we're never given purview into any of those challenges or areas for our clients?
You know, I find myself getting a little bit frustrated with that. And here's why. I feel like the user experience field in general has had to persuade clients of the right way to do things since day one. And I think you could go back 15 years and have clients say like, well, can't we just have a developer make this website? Or why do we need anything other than a graphic designer? Like, you know, why do we need a user experience person at all? Why do we need to do user research? Why do we need to, you know, there's a million things that we have basically gone to our clients and said, no, really, like you have to do it this way. This is the right way to do it. And I don't know why we just roll over and play dead when it comes to the content. Like, we're better than that. And frankly, this is such a glaring area of need for so many clients that I would, you know, it's like push back on them. I mean, you have to have a story to tell, and you have to have the confidence to go in and say, no, right, remember when you didn't think we had to go actually talk to real users? Well, we convinced you that that was important. Now we're going to convince you that the content's important, and here are my talking points as to why that's the case. Will you win every argument? No, of course not. I mean, I lost my fair share of battles with various user experience points of process over the years, but as the field evolves, you know, you just get this increasing recognition of like, oh, okay, everybody's talking about this now. I guess we should think about doing it this way.
Right.
And just, yeah, it takes a bunch of smart people going to clients and saying like, hey, quit doing it the wrong way.
So you mentioned going in and sort of having your talking points. You gave a talk at Confab that was one of the most popular talks this year about selling content strategy. Do you want to kind of give a high-level overview of some of the points that you delivered in that talk?
So I think for me, the genesis of that talk was really thinking about content strategy as change management, or as maybe even a better way to put it is I like the word adaptation, and because I think it's not, people don't like change, you know, and when you're coming in and saying, oh, now you have to do all this stuff on the internet, you have to support the website, that means your job is going to change. That makes people feel uncomfortable, like they don't know what to do. But if you think of it more as like, how are we going to get this organization to adapt? How are we going to, you know, how do we get them to be more flexible and recognize that, oh yeah, the world changes, but we can evolve along with it. And, you know, to me, adaptation suggests something that's more empowering to people than just saying like, okay, time for change. So I'm very interested in a lot of the problems around why do people want to keep doing things exactly the way they've always done them before, even if that continues to cause pain? And, you know, when most of what I think about content strategy and user experience in general, as I've done this more and more, I realize it's for me, I'm less interested in specific tactical questions about, you know, what's the right way to design this page, or what's the right way to use these types of form elements, or, you know, what are the right content strategy deliverables? And I'm more interested in like these bigger questions of like organizational change. How do you get businesses to change their mindset and change their workflow so that they can support all of the publishing challenges that they have on the web, for example, like the web and social and mobile? And then how do you get them to change the way they think about, it's like, to me, the big mindset shift is you're going from, you know, either a marketing-driven mindset or a technology-driven mindset to essentially a user-centered mindset. It's how do we change the way the people in our business think so that they get that what they are doing is creating products and services for users to be used by other people. I think some businesses do that really well. I think there's a lot of businesses that do that really poorly. And I'm particularly fascinated by how that happens. And I think the content space is such a fascinating area just because I think we all recognize, like, hey, if businesses are going to keep up with the demands of the hungry internet beast, they really are going to have to be more effective internally. They have to do a better job. And so how do we persuade them that content strategy has tools and techniques and an approach that will help them do that?
How do we persuade them of that, Karen?
Well, you know, I gave another talk at the IAA Summit. I did a workshop there a few years back where, you know, my perspective on it is that your skills as a user experience professional are in many cases the same sorts of skills that should serve you in trying to understand what would be persuasive to people in an organization. It's like talk about yourself, think about yourself and your ideas like they're a product that needs to be used by other people within the organization. And think of the people that you're trying to persuade as your users, as the users of you. And it comes down to fundamentally being respectful of where they're coming from and what the fact that they may have equally valid value systems, motivations. You know, they may be coming from a place where they're like, you know, I happen to think differently from you, and I'm not wrong. And so you have to sort of get in there and say, okay, well, what is this person going to be persuaded by? What is going to motivate this person? And to me, a lot of it comes down to, you know, organizational structure and policy things like the incentive system. I think a lot of people are measured and incentivized to do things a certain way. And that is not necessarily aligned with, you know, the goals of the website or, you know, successful publishing practices.
Can you give an example?
Well, one example that the example that I always give is, you know, thinking back at a past project where, you know, the website needed to get redesigned and nobody wanted to do this project. It was like, you know, people would, you know, there'd be this like sort of rah, rah, yeah, we're going to get the website done. And then it wasn't anybody, you know, everybody would get distracted. Everybody had other jobs to do, you know, and it wasn't anyone's focus. And so the project would just drag on. And finally, you know, the guy who was running the project, like they put it on his performance review that the website had to be done that year. And by God, the website was done that year. You know, it's like those
amazing.
Kinds of, like, I know, it's shocking. People are motivated by, you know, by incentives or by their performance goals. And there's a great management consulting paper called On the Folly of Rewarding A While Hoping for B. And it's like right now, I think a lot of organizations are rewarding A while hoping for a better website.
I would agree with that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Hey, so one other thing that I wanted to be sure to give you the opportunity to talk about is something that we've been having lots of impassioned phone calls and IM conversations about. And that is this idea of starting to work with dealing with preparing our content for multi-platform distribution in a world where we have no idea which platforms we're going to be preparing it for in the next 6, 12, 18 months. You and Jeff Eaton gave a really, really eye-opening presentation at the Web Content Conference in Chicago, specifically around this topic, with Jeff coming at it from he's with Lullabot, which they're a Drupal consulting firm. And you came at it specifically as more of a content strategist with an IA bent. Can you talk a little bit about the genesis of that talk and the core issues as you see them, and sort of what you're hoping to be able to get out there as general knowledge and the conversation that you're hoping to start?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of excitement, as I'm sure you're well aware, about Ethan Marcotte's responsive web design book, and you know, and sort of the overall approach of how do we think about creating websites for, you know, a variety of platforms that may appear in a variety of different screen sizes. And, you know, how do we think about doing that in a responsive, adaptive, flexible way, which I think is brilliant. And I think
so that we don't have to recreate it over and over for each individual platform. Yeah,
so that you're not maintaining multiple versions of the site, but rather you have one code base and it dynamically responds based on what you know about the device or the screen resolution that the user's coming in with.
Yep, and that he's coming at it specifically from the design.
This is what I'm saying. I think, and you know, to me, it's we have done so much work on the design side to explain to designers that on the web you have to give up control. Okay, you don't necessarily know what your users, you know, machine's capabilities are. You can't make everything pixel perfect the way that you would make it in print. So you have to design a flexible system that can adapt and be responsive to a variety of different ways that the user might be seeing it, which we've spent so much time on the design side talking about that. And no one has ever really said the same thing to the content creators. I think you still have a lot of content creators that are really thinking about where their stuff is going to live on the website. And that, to me, is, I think, probably one of the biggest things that we have to change. And again, I think, in my mind, that's an organizational challenge. Jeff Eaton and I have had many conversations about how tough it is to explain to a content creator who's going to be using the CMS that they're moving from creating static pages to creating, you know, nodes of content in Drupal that can appear in lots of different places based on metadata and business rules.
And that content has been called intelligent content by Ann Rockley. She's been writing about this very topic since the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. Naz Urbina in England, in the UK, has been doing the Cangility conference that was previously called XPubs. He calls it agile content. Most recently, Rachel Lovinger last year wrote that terrific white paper for Razorfish and called it nimble content. So this conversation is not necessarily new. We've been talking about preparing content for, if not cross-platform distribution, then at least so that it can be delivered in multiple places online at once. So what's driving this conversation now? Is it the responsive design movement? Is it the need to deliver it cross-platform? And how are we going to pull this in specifically to the content strategy conversation when it is really something that has been owned by the CMS crew for so long?
Right. I think one of the biggest challenges is that it gets treated like it's a technology problem and not like it's a strategy problem and not like it's a content workflow problem. And I think that a lot of the work that these, you know, Ann Rockley and Naz Urbina, I think Rachel's Nimble report was phenomenal. I think we have to keep pushing the content creators to grasp how important it is to do things this way. I think we have to push back on things like, you know, WYSIWYG text editors in CMSs and say, no, really, this is not about you having something that looks like Microsoft Word. This is about you creating content that might appear formatted in different ways, structured in different ways, and lots of different platforms. And you have to be able to start thinking in systems. And I think that I do really point to the CMS community as, you know, they they need to play a strong role in this. But if we're not doing a good enough job of explaining to organizations, explaining to content creators why they have to do things this way, it's hard for people to understand. It becomes this like alphabet soup of different, RDF and XML and, all sorts of different APIs. And, it's like we have to take a step back from that and talk about here's what this means and here's how you think about content differently and here's how you write content differently or create it differently to support that. And, so I think that does mean different tools. But more importantly, it means we have to explain it in a way that gets people to realize like, oh, okay, that's why we have to do it this way. And I think mobile is a great, it's going to be a really helpful wedge there because you just see the panic on people's faces where they're like, what do you mean? I have to support the iPhone and Android and BlackBerry and the tablet and I have to do native apps and I have to do a mobile website and is this ever going to get better? And you just laugh and you're like, no, it's going to get worse. There's going to be even more platforms and even more competing standards. And, at a certain point you go, oh, wow, the only way we're ever going to be able to support all those things is if we have, a reusable content store that is flexible and intelligent and nimble.
So that concept basically just like derailed my entire keynote that was happening the next day in a really, really great way. But all of a sudden that was like all I wanted to talk about. Where, I think that people are feeling really overwhelmed to a pretty large degree about figuring out how to bring their specific skill set into the realm of content strategy to begin to learn and be able to speak with authority about these different areas of the discipline, not just from the editorial perspective, but also structurally and with regard to, workflow and governance, which, like, as you said, backs into organizational design and change management. So putting this piece of the puzzle, on the table, I'm just a little worried about people's brains melting. So can you maybe provide sort of some good basic resources that just to begin to kind of get their arms around this table? Where could people go around this topic? Where could people go or what could they read or what could they be following to sort of watch this emerge?
So I think you already mentioned, a couple of good ones, which I think everybody should read Rachel Lovinger's Nimble report. It blew my mind when she put that out, last year or a couple of years ago.
Well, and it's an easy read. That's what blew my mind is I was like, oh my God, Nimble content. But then I sat down and read it. And what's brilliant about it is that it's written for like normal people who thinking about why is this getting worse every single day?
Yep. I think it's beautifully designed. It presents the concepts in a way that, anybody can understand. But she also doesn't dumb it down too much. It does a really nice overview of here are lots of different ways that you need to be thinking about this. And, this is why, yes, it's like, you're right. When you get into talking about metadata too much, people's eyes start to glaze over. But if you give them some very straightforward, practical examples, it starts to be like, oh, okay, I understand that. And also you mentioned Anne Rockley, who, really should get a lot of credit for beating the drum on this subject for quite some time. And I would say I'm getting a lot of benefit just from following all the conversation about responsive web design. And, I think it's getting enough traction that I do think the conversation is naturally starting to turn to content. Or, people are saying like, okay, let's talk about the content first. Like, well, what does that mean? And to me, it's like, it comes down to prioritization. I think that's the question that everybody is trying to figure out is if you're saying like, okay, well, we have to prioritize content differently. Maybe we structure the content differently. Maybe we write the content differently because we have to have different priorities for mobile. How do you know what that is? And I think most important, if people are saying like, great, this is our opportunity to go to these website owners and say 80% of the stuff you have on your homepage is crap, let's get rid of it. How do you have that conversation? And, how do you have that conversation in a way that gets everybody focused on the right thing, which is the user experience, and not necessarily on fight, you know, continuing these battles over, you know, who gets their blob on the homepage in the most prominent place.
If someone has been tasked on the client side, if someone has been tasked with a mobile website, let's figure out how we're going to do a mobile website. And that, you know, let's say the current website is like 120 pages and what they've been told is we've got to get this on mobile. Much like over the past several years, people have been told we've got to get on Twitter. We've got to get on Facebook. We've got to get on YouTube. We've got to have a corporate blog. We need to go back to our copy and make sure that it's search engine optimized. If someone is told, get us a mobile website, how can they begin to sort of push back or help shift perspective with regard to the idea that it's not just about the platform? I mean, you and I can sit here and talk about the, you know, necessities of multi-platform content distribution and how that's going to get even worse. But this repeating thing that seems to happen, you know, how do we begin to shift perspective from our managers, our directors, our executive folks about, you know, it's not the platform, it's the strategy itself. Does that go back to the user again? And I'll tag this on. If it does go back to the user, what are we, you know, how can we continue to sort of tie together those user objectives and goals with our business strategy? Mm-hmm. Can you answer that in 30 seconds?
In 12 words or less.
Yes.
I think that, you know, I've had a lot of luck with talking to clients about the early days of the web and my frustration, even at a very young age, with the sort of like mad dash to the internet that these businesses were making. I mean, you just got a lot of phone calls from people that were like, we need a website. We need a website right now. And you would try to sit down with them and say, okay, well, why do you need a website? And they'd be like, cause we need a website.
Right.
And you know, that's not a very productive conversation because it's like, well, okay, well, how are you going to know if the website that we put up for you is actually working? And, or more to the point, a lot of businesses put up websites that then did not meet their business goals and were forced then to take a step back and go, oh, right, we don't just need a website. We need a website that does what it's supposed to. Two totally different things. Same, and it's the same conversation with mobile. I mean, I joked after the iPad came out that it was like my phone rang off the hook all week with publishers that, you know, it was basically they're calling me up and the phone conversation was, iPad. And, you know, and I'm like, I turned a lot of that work down because I'm like, look, I'm not in the business of, you know, working my team to death for 3 weeks to get so that you can just have something in the App Store when it launches. If you can't articulate for me, how is this going to help your business? Like, how are you going to support this in the future? You know, I think you've seen a lot of publishers get really hamstrung by heavily art-directed apps or, you know, complicated apps that they don't have the publishing infrastructure to support. And, you know, to me, it's saying, like, we can't go back to those bad old days where you just threw something up on the web or threw something up on your handset and hoped that people liked it. You have to start it with a strategy. And, you know, I think for a lot of businesses, it is going to mean saying not how do we get our stuff on this mobile website, but assuming that we will eventually have to get our stuff on, you know, a mobile website and an iPhone app and an Android app and various tablets, how are we setting ourselves up for success so that in the future, when we do want to get onto a new platform, we feel confident that we can do it?
Yes. Here's another. I get this question a lot. I get a lot of pushback because people want to see content strategy samples, right? Like, show me content strategy in action. Show me somebody who is doing content strategy right. That's a difficult thing for me to be able to put up on a screen for an audience, because ultimately what I'm showing them is detailed recommendations that have flowed from the strategic objectives that have been executed. So having said that, Karen, who's doing content strategy right?
Well, you know, one of my favorite case studies that I've seen recently, at least on this particular topic, is the NPR case study around how they created a content API that they can use to publish both to their desktop site, but then also to all of the various mobile platforms that they need to publish to. And what that did is it resulted in them being able to generate those apps more quickly. But it also resulted in some like crazy increase in page views on their desktop site, like 70% increase. And it's like, that's money. Okay. Like they're a publishing site. Like, you know, that 70% more page views equals 70% more ad impressions equals 70% more money. I mean, maybe not, but you know what I mean? To me, that's a great example of how they're looking at their content strategically and saying, what do we need to do from an organizational perspective, from a content management perspective, from other tools and workflow perspective, so that we can make our content work harder for us. And that will result in us being more efficient and effective as a business.
You know, that's so interesting for me because I think that, I don't know if it's because of my background in copywriting. I don't know if it's because so much of the focus on content over the last 2 years as the topic has risen to such prominence has been really presented with marketing copy more than anything else. But what's interesting to me about that is here you're talking about content as a product, right? As being strategically considered as a product that needs to be distributed across platforms. It's difficult for me as a content strategist to separate that out from the substance component, from the messaging, from, you know, where, from audience consideration and targeting and so on. And I know that the API enabled them to begin to work with that and do that. What from sort of more of like an editorial content perspective, I mean, obviously NPR is a leader in creating quality content, but let's say from a services firm perspective, do you have any examples of organizations who you feel like are getting it right, whether it is on their website or mobile or both?
Well, I think, you know, that's an interesting question because, you know, yes, there is a difference between businesses that treat their content like a product and businesses where the content is really marketing in the support of selling a different product or service. But you know, in a very real sense, I think successful businesses are thinking about their content as, you know, an ongoing product that they have to create. And, you know, even though it might be in the service of marketing, some of the challenges in terms of their internal workflow, their editorial processes, their technology processes, you know, the CMS, they're basically the same thing, right? I mean, if you're regularly publishing blogs and white papers and podcasts and videos in support of marketing your service, it's not that much different. I mean, maybe at a smaller scale, but you have many of the same problems that a large-scale content developer like NPR has. You know, you're still have to think about where's that content going to live? How are we going to reuse it? You know, do we have the resources to create it and maintain it? How do we make sure that we extract the most value out of the content that we're creating? And so, you know, I think that the services firms that are really thinking about, wow, okay, how do we make sure that we can measure and get value from the content that we create to market our services? And then are thinking like, hey, we may not even know where our prospective clients are looking at us anymore. Like you'd like to think they're all sitting at their desktop, like deeply engaged in your corporate website, but maybe they're on their phone. Maybe they're browsing, they're looking for a firm and they're on the train. So what are you doing to set yourself up so that those messages get to your audience in an appropriate format, regardless of platform?
You know, as we're talking, something that I'm sort of recognizing is this. We've talked a lot about, and there's been sort of some pushback and sort of refrains occurring within the core content strategy community. Folks are really participating actively in the conversation and creating content about content strategy, that a lot of the focus is on marketing content, which, you know, I'm sort of starting to see that, for example, we talk about content marketing. And what we're really talking about there is more, I don't want to say advertising, because I know it's not just the awareness cycle that we're working with, but actually sort of selling a product or a service. Like when we talk about marketing communications or content marketing, we're talking about putting systems in place that will support that early stage of, or those early stages of the sales cycle, in my mind anyway. there's so many other kinds of content. There's, you know, all the internal content that, that companies deal with on their intranets. You know, it's IP, it's HR communications, it is corporate communications, it is subject matter expert knowledge share, it is, you know, internal departmental policy, whatever the case may be. That is kind of the stuff that I think is more difficult for us to get at, to be able to talk about, to kind of pull that into the content strategy conversation. I think that concern that the content strategy conversation is getting hijacked by the content marketing conversation or overshadowed by it. Would you agree that we need to really find ways to kind of pull out case studies that are also looking at how content strategy can and should be having an impact on a lot of that internally facing content and how that relates to content that's externally facing to potential clients?
Oh God, yes. I mean, of course, like I'm going to say no to that.
Yeah. Would you agree, Reed, as now that I've said my piece, I'll try to throw it back to you, Karen, my interview subject.
Let me rephrase that in the form of a question. You think I'm right, don't you? No, I do a lot of work with Dachas Group and their like whole social business practice. And I think they, you know, they too have some of the same challenges around a lot of the social stuff does get, you know, it's like the reduction to marketing, where everything is like, okay, how can we use this for marketing content? And it's about how do we make everything in our organization more efficient? And that means all of our internal processes and policies. It's like, what's going on that intranet? And how do we, it's not even just how do we go into the intranet and be like, wow, you've got 75,000 pages of crap in here. Maybe we should get rid of some of it. It's saying, how do we take advantage of what our employees are saying and doing and some of the things that might be happening on the intranet in terms of internal conversations or discussions or knowledge sharing? And how do we make that more transparent or, you know, invite people to participate in it more? So it's like, I'm not saying make the HR policies public on your website, but I am saying, think about all, you know, for a business, it's like, think about all the content that you are creating and the employee resources that are going to creating that content, wherever it lives, and think about how do you extract more value from it. And maybe some of it is, wow, our employees are saying really smart things on our intranet that no one can hear about. I've worked with clients where I've gone into their intranet and been like, look at all these amazing discussions here. Your employees know more about this business than anybody out there. Why is your marketing site completely static? Like, why not share?
Because legal says we can't.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Karen, our time is just about up. Are there any other topics you'd like to broach that you feel are important to be on the radar for our listening community?
You know, I think I would reiterate what you're saying, which is that in my mind, content strategy is like a vertical that crosses, you know, marketing all the way down to technology. And, you know, my view of the user experience field is that when people started having to create digital products and services in their business, it's like, you know, that was the first time that marketing and IT ever had to sit down at the table together and be like, hey, wouldn't it be fun if we all collaborated on the website?
Hey.
And to me, that's where the user experience field, like, kind of was able to insert itself and say, you know, we understand your goals as marketers. We understand your values or your needs in technology. And we're here to help you, to help bridge the gap between these two perspectives. And ideally, by taking your focus away from, like, arguing with each other and putting the focus on the user and getting everybody kind of pointed in the same direction of, here's how we make decisions. It's by focusing on what the user wants. And so when I look at content strategy, I'm like, it's a vertical that crosses all three of those things. And, you know, I personally like to come at it from the user experience standpoint. You know, I'm kind of looking at the marketing people and looking at the CMS people and saying, like, okay, like, same deal here. Like, let's think about the perspective of the user and how that might help us align on having a shared set of goals and values.
And that word align, I think, is what's so key. And that's so much of what I've been doing recently, is trying to educate people on how to think like consultants and how to facilitate these meetings like consultants. Because if you can't get people to align on a larger goal, you know, they're going to keep hammering away at, well, you know, the tech team wants this, the marketing team wants this, and even the UX team wants this, and so on.
Right, right. And, you know, for me, I think one of the most powerful things in content strategy is the idea that internal users are still users. And, you know, we have to think about the experience of the people who are creating and maintaining that content. We have to give them, you know, better and more effective tools to do so. And that's not, you know, that's not a UX, and to me, that's not a UX perspective, and it's not a technology perspective, and it's not a marketing perspective. It's a content strategy perspective that says, you know, our businesses need to be more efficient and more creative in terms of generating content, maintaining their content. And it's not just because I want to be nice to users. It's because that's business value.
You're smart.
It's fun to talk to you. Which is why I do it all the time.
Karen, just to wrap up, one of the things that I enjoy mocking you about is that you have been saying for the past couple of years that you're not really a content strategist, to which I have replied, you're doing an awfully good job of acting like a famous content strategist. You are going to be speaking quite a bit more in the coming months. You are doing a couple of gigs for An Event Apart. You are delivering a keynote at the Content Strategy Forum EU. So I just want to encourage listeners to keep an eye out for those opportunities to hear Ms. Karen McGrane be smart out in the world. Karen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for letting me ramble on your podcast.
Oh, I've enjoyed the rambling as always. And to our fair listeners, thank you so much for joining us on this edition of Content Talks, and we will see you next week.
Bye.